This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tong Phac.
My name is Ann Doe, and I'm currently the Executive Creative Director, Head of Music at Expedia Group.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all of...
Thank you for coming on the podcast. You know, when I was introduced to you, I immediately was like, wait, Expedia, the travel company, has a music department? And that's why we're here, is to talk about this incredible like niche where commerce meets music. And I want to know where sort of did you start in the music world?
Yeah, I guess I grew up like, you know, most, you know, Asian or Vietnamese kids playing classical piano. And then around, you know, I think preteen, I discovered pop music, but really indie music, punk music. I inherited some records from my uncle, who was only a few years older than me. And that's just, I think, where my relationship with music began. And I was deeply just obsessed with music. And I never thought it would be a career. And then, you know, fast forward a few years, I was in a band in my 20s, early 20s, and we put out some records. We toured. It was a very small indie band. And
what did you play? Did you sing?
Originally I played guitar, but then I realized I'm actually better at keyboards. So I just said, hey, I think I'm just better suited at keyboards, just because I had the, you know, classical piano background. And actually, I didn't know what I was doing, so I watched a lot of late night TV and did live performances and kind of learned how to play kind of pop music from that. And then I played, then there was an opportunity, Friends with Friends, where I did play for a pop star. And I didn't tell you this when we met, but it was 2000. At least 20 years ago, I played for Gwen Stefani for like almost a year as her keyboardist when she did her solo
That's
album.
That's insane. And that is insane.
I know, it's really, it's crazy. It's fun to tell people that.
Yeah, because, you know, I come here for like the corporate, you know, Expedia, yeah. and then it's like, wait, what?
In actuality, like Expedia Group is like my first corporate job, anything. I was always this kind of living, you know, didn't think that was my trajectory. Like, I didn't have those aspirations. I never identified as that person. And then, you know, I did, you know, played music as a musician in a band that was very niche, not popular, but we got to tour and like we were, you know, we did all the things that kind of indie bands did. Played for a pop star, and then things kind of, you know, just opportunities landed my way where I didn't want to be in a band, so I didn't do that for a few years. And then naturally, I had opportunities where it was like where I landed behind the scenes, and then all of a sudden it was like, bam, I'm in music again. I'm not playing, never wanted to really do that because it was quite gave me anxiety playing for like a big audience like I did. And then was in a, had my own kind of creative agency with two partners for a dozen years.
When you were going through this sort of world of like being in a band and stuff, like where were your mom and dad? Did they give you any pressure? I want to.
Yeah. So I have an older sister, and I think, so I came to the States. We were refugees. I was born in Vietnam, and we left in 1979, 1980. So not the first wave, but a bit later, my parents didn't think we were going to move. Like, they really wanted to stay, but then they realized it wasn't going to get better. So then we landed, we were in a camp for 6 months, then we were in California. And I think growing up, I think they just loved us. And they just like, you can be whoever you want. There wasn't that pressure where you have to be a doctor or lawyer. Yes, there were, you know, things were said, like comparisons were made. Like, oh my God, so-and-so's daughter is doing this. And we're like, so? You know, like, I'm not interested in being a pharmacist or, you know. And I think they just like, okay, well, you just, in many ways, like, let us do what we wanted to do. And that's where I had kind of the freedom. And I lived in Huntington Beach, Orange County. There was, you know, this is a time, was it in the 90s, where, you know, in suburbia, you just had a lot of things to do. I mean, not a lot of things to do, but there was just so much to kind of, I don't know, discover. And how do you find music? I mean, there was this pre-internet age. I went to record stores. I read fanzines. I discovered things in a very different way than how people do it now.
And your mom and dad were always supportive.
They were. I think they were confused where this was going to go, but not once did they deny me anything. Like, you have to figure out your path. So it was really cool. Like, it was very different from other families.
And thank God for that, right? I mean, because then we get to see the Vietnamese diaspora unfold in just very cool ways. But one of the things that help perpetuate these cool ways are like cool parents.
Yeah.
You know, the support. My mom and dad were like that too. They never really pressured us to, other than becoming priests.
Yes.
But that's a different story, right? Uh-huh. There's no academic pressures, or there's no like, you should be a doctor or anything like that.
Yeah. I mean, there were like the standard, I think, stereotypical pressures of like, do well in school. I did well in school. I went to the college. Like, you know, I did all those things. But I think the profession was like, it was kind of left alone a bit.
And what did you study in college?
I went to UCLA and I studied history, which is like very open-ended. And then after college, I just traveled. Like, I made enough money where it's like, okay, I can go to Europe. And then I think after 22, and this is during around 96, 97, I went to Vietnam. I lived there for 6 months by myself. And my parents were very worried. And not a lot of people were there yet. I mean, in terms of like Viet Q.
What year was that, you said?
Let me see. If I graduated, I think it was 1996.
You graduated from UCLA in 96?
95. I graduated early. But I kind of bookended it with, it must have been 97, because I was there in Hong Kong for the handover. So it was 97.
That's very early.
Very early. There was not a lot of
VQ.
Like, Clinton lifted the embargo. There was one ATM at the fanciest hotel. My where I lived, there was a dial-up for the modem, that for the internet, that sometimes worked and sometimes didn't. I actually wrote and mailed letters. You know, it was pretty wild west. Or East, I guess. And I wonder if I had just stayed there. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of people we know live there.
You regret it?
I don't think so, because I remember after living there for so many months, then I went to Hong Kong. And I was just like, you know, oh my God, the Western world. Like, oh my God, look at these, like, new fashions, or, you know, like, I felt like I was so totally closed off from it. I had no idea what was happening in the world or what I thought, you know. And then I went back in 2000, not for a long time later. I didn't go back till 2010. So it was a long, like, over a decade. And I met all these, like, Viet Qs. I mean, I was like, wow, like, they're thriving. This is amazing. Like, could I live here? And I think a part of me was like, I don't think you can, because you're so American. like maybe there's just certain things that I, certain cultural things that I'm obsessed with growing up, where music and fashion, culture, books, like it's not, it doesn't feel fully me there. Like it's hard to explain. I think I can live there for bits of time, but I feel like maybe the privilege today of saying is like, I can be global and I can like go back and forth. I feel like that I could do. But when I lived there in 97, people didn't think I was Vietnamese. I had really short hair. They thought I was Japanese or Chinese or who, you know, and I felt a little bit awkward. I'm like, I dress very differently. I'm like, I'm not sure if I belong, you know.
Nobody belongs in Vietnam or the U.S. So nobody belongs anywhere.
Yeah.
It's just, I think bringing your own flavor to any place that we live is, I don't know. It's like artists do that, right? And when you're that young, sometimes we don't see the value in that at the time.
Yeah, it was a pretty wild time. Like, there were just a few clubs. Like, I met a few people. I mean, I felt in a weird way, it was the most free I felt. I think I was 21, 22, because there wasn't anyone there yet. And the people who were there were felt like they were outcasts, or they were trying to start something, or if they weren't, they were entrepreneurs that wanted to start something new and trying to figure out how they could do it in that environment.
6 months, huh? 95, 96. That's so early.
Yeah. And my parents were scared. They're like, you don't know what you're getting yourself into. My grandmother was living there still.
Okay. But when you got back after 6 months, did you like give the middle finger to your mom? And I'm not, you know, not that way, but did you say, look, like I did that and it's like, I'm fine. And the government and, you know, the living, everything was okay.
I think some things were hidden for me in terms of like, I don't know. I think my parents, or my mom especially, just like, always worrying. And I said, I'm fine. I can take care of myself. I know how to travel. And, but I think they were just like kind of still traumatized from their own experience, which they never talk about. I mean, now looking back, like, wow, like my dad was in his late 30s, like pretty pre-war was kind of successful. You know, we pretty established, like, and for them to make the decision to leave, it's pretty bad. I'm trying to, they're getting pretty old now, and I'm trying to get to do like record my dad, especially of like talking about the stories, and because it's really hard, they don't want to talk about it, you know. Mm-hmm. I hear bits and pieces throughout the years, but the whole story isn't complete, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I have just started to get paid to interview and in Vietnamese, mm-hmm. and then get it translated mm-hmm. into English for people to use for their books or their family histories. And there is so much that we don't know, mm-hmm. because there's these individual records of, you know, people that have done things in their time in Vietnam, and now they live in the US in their 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, I wish that we could just do that on a global scale where we get all the stories, you know, because they're just beautiful vignettes of difficulties and things that people have overcome. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a wonderful time, but it's, you know, it's, these people are getting older, and we should, you know, get more into mm-hmm. turning on the tape recorder. I mean, it's very simple to do, and
yeah, it's just finding that right kind of emotional state for them to share.
Yeah,
yeah.
But oftentimes, what I've heard from people now is that they're willing to share. Mm-hmm. But it's just us not doing the scheduling, saying, Mom and Dad, I need you to sit down. And we're sitting here thinking that they're emotionally scarred or whatever. But
true.
The reality is, like, they're ready to go. Everybody likes to talk. Yeah. That's what I've learned.
Yeah. Gosh, maybe you should talk to my dad.
Would love to. I would love to have a conversation with your father. Yeah, I would love to. Going back to this drop off in music and touring and, you know, and having anxiety, what do you think that came from?
Did the anxiety part?
The anxiety part, and then like dropping out of the music scene. I mean, I would be I would be devastated if I got to that point and then like left, you know? Sounds like a lot of work. And you've attained a certain...
Yeah, I think it was complex in that the feelings. Like, I was in a band with friends, musicians that weren't, that I thought many ways were better than me in terms of talent. I think growing up, I studied classical piano, so I can read music well, but I felt deficient in ear training, which is what maybe I had wished we focused on more with my teacher, but that wasn't the kind of curriculum. And then here I am in like a band.
The real world.
Yeah, where the musicians weren't trained in the way I was, and they were just very confident and they could, you know, pick up something, hear something and just pick it up. And I felt like, I don't think I'm that good, or, you know, like it's harder for me to just get it. That's what I felt. So there was always that kind of anxiety to begin with, but I did fine. But I think there's always this anxious part of me. And then, you know, playing for a big pop star, it was just next level. And I was like, I don't think I can do it, but I did it. But it's like, it would take a lot to mentally prepare myself and make myself do it.
Did you ever fuck up?
No. But I felt on the verge of messing up all the time. Or like, there'll be times where like, right before we'll go on stage or play something, I'm like, I don't remember that. You know what? But then you're just like, but you do remember it. But you know, there's just always like a second guessing. Yeah. And then I feel sick to my stomach. And then afterwards, there's either like a sense of euphoria or just like a relief. It was very intense emotionally. And I think, I don't know if I was like, you know, mentally, you know, prepared, not like other people. Like, I think I just had to, I did a lot of questioning of like, is this fun? And then it'll be like, oh my God, that was so fun. You know, like the long day of, you know, being in a van, setting up for like an hour of this feeling was worth it. But I think over time, and maybe I think I also grew up where I'm like, I don't know, like, I don't know if this is worth it, you know? So I think that's where, I think it's just kind of, I was evolving into someone else with different interests. So I think that's where, I think I had like a decade playing live. Like, it's not like I did my time, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, when you because I kind of went through that journey and I dropped out. I did it for 6 years and I didn't achieve any how far you got, but I certainly felt that I was not as good as the kids in music school. And I always go back and forth. Is it a brain horsepower thing, or did I just not spend enough years in service, right? Like, do you think that if you spent more time doing it, that you would have gotten better? Or do you think it's like one of those things where like, if you pick up pitching a baseball at 7 years old and you get the majors, like your arm is now fully developed, mm-hmm. where that muscle memory is all caked in there, and now asking you to do it at 22 or whatever is like, it's asking like a regular person to lift 500 pounds on a curl.
It's a combination. I mean, I think always hard work means something, but I also think you just have it or you don't. I think I think from where I like the kind of stuff I was playing, one could do it. You know, it wasn't technically challenging. It's pop music, you know? It's like, you know, three chords, song structures, yeah. You know? And I almost felt like, yeah, you could do it. Could you get better? Like, maybe technically, yes, but not, there's limitations to that. You know, so I think if I, you know, at that point, I had already learned what I need to learn in terms of reading, learning about music, you know. So I guess, I don't think maybe I didn't have it in me to chase that dream, you know. Maybe my dream changed.
Do you miss it today?
Not really. A few years ago, I had these friends. I'm still friends with them, and they, had like a performance art group, musical group, and I played with them, you know, throughout the years. And then they had like a big big show at the Whitney Museum, and during the pandemic, and they brought the original kind of band group back, and we did a performance, and I hadn't played in a decade. I had to find my keyboard that was in storage from a friend's. I had to kind of remember the, you know, synth settings and different sounds. And then we had rehearsal, and I had to memorize like 2 hours of music in like a week or two. And then we had to play live. That was very nerve-wracking. And then again, I was like, God, I'm just not good enough. Like, I'm so rusty. Like, all these like musicians have been playing these years, you know. They have, yes, they do other things, but they've been at it where I haven't. And again, that feeling of being in the band in my 20s was like, it came back where it's like, maybe you're not, like, you're just not, it's not like I feel like I'm not good enough. It's just like, you're just, I don't feel bad. I'm just like, maybe this isn't really you, but you could do it and you're gonna do it. But just kind of get through it. It's not the best way. It's not how I like to operate. But I don't know. Maybe I'm just like traumatized by being in an indie band where we went toward America. It was like a 15-passenger van, and everyone's miserable in the car because we're driving for 6 hours, and then we get to the destination, we set up, and we play, and it's like everyone's having the best time after the performance. And then we do it again the next day, you know? I don't know.
Do you feel like, as an adult now, in an important position that you at work now, but do you still harbor those I'm not good enough feelings? Like, oh, these corporate guys are so, you know, well-versed. They all got MBAs, and, you know, they know their and here I am, I'm like, you know, again, an outsider.
Yeah, you know, when I started, I was kind of like, there was a huge learning curve. I'm like, what are these acronyms people are saying? What's, like, I was really fascinated by the acronyms, the language. And I was like, oh my gosh, like, you could do that. I was telling myself, like, you need to, like, I'm always self-motivating myself. Like, you need to just, like, research or, like, study up, you know. But then now I'm like in a very comfortable place. Like, I'm doing a really great job, you know. There's not doubt in this position, and I think I had to kind of, you know, 2 years in, I know the lingo, I know the different personalities. It's a lot of people skills, but in terms of like my specialty or talent, I'm super confident that I know what I'm doing. I back it up with context, with research. I can articulate what I want to say, because I am supposed to be the authority in music. So it's maybe for the first time where I feel super confident about myself. And maybe it's just growing up and aging.
Yeah. Aging.
Like, it's aging. Like, I don't care. Mm-hmm. I know that I know my work is good. I can back it up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think it took all these decades, but also like all these different, you know, paths in my life have maybe led me here. So yeah, it's different. Now, if you ask me, do you want to play for this, you know, like this performance, I'll be like, I'm not sure about that. So maybe that's still like a very sensitive, you know, area, but the job thing feels good, you know.
So when you leave the band, you're playing for Gwen Stefani, you leave and you create an agency, and that, you said 12 years, that's a long time. What exactly did you do in those 12 years?
You know, that also came, I met these two, you know, through this other job I was doing, and it was not, we didn't have a plan. I think a lot of the new, a lot of my major phase, the major phases in my life, it's not really like a calculated plan. I stumbled on it. We met each other. We got on. There was a music opportunity to do a music series. We love music. Let's just do it.
What's a music series?
Oh, we did this music series for a hotel that back then not a lot of people did. So we would kind of put together a program of like performances. We produced it. We did the, you know, we did
kinda
the marketing for it.
Kind of like Hotel Cafe?
Yeah, but like it was for a music hotel group. And again, like we didn't have major aspirations. We were just, we did it because for the love of music, like we just, and it was successful and they asked us to do more and we're like, okay. And then it became like some other people would like, would you like to do that? You know, it became like something real where I was like, wow, this is a very viable and feasible
business model.
Yeah. But even then, I wasn't really thinking that way. You know, it was just like the opportunity presented itself. Let's try it. And then we saw something there and we took the, you know, capitalized on it. We took the opportunity and made it into something. And then it evolved itself into, well, we can do music programming or series, cultural programming for bigger institutions. Okay, we could do this for pop stars. Great, you know, so, and then, oh, why don't we represent musicians or directors for musicians? Because we see an opportunity there. Okay, so I think that's, it wasn't like this like 5-year plan. That was not how we operated back then. We were still like, just like, you know, many ways flumming, like just musicians that or creative people that wanted to make, you know, work we could be proud of and have fun. And then as we grew, it's like, okay, like this is supporting us or livelihood. Like, how do we make this into something more? Then it became more of a profession.
Wow.
But I always think I'm like a late bloomer. Like I tried so many, you know, not wildly different paths, but like within kind of music, but like, could I have had this corporate job any other time? I don't know. But it came to me when I was ready for it. I wasn't really looking for it. I was interested in it for a while. And then the pandemic, and I really wanted to try something new. And for me, corporate was exotic. I had some friends in corporate. I mean, it's weird to say that, but it was exotic and it felt like really stable. And all the things I had before were not as stable. And I think I needed that stability.
Yeah.
And you know, to stake through time and knowing people, I was presented with something and I'm really grateful for it because now I really feel very...
You've arrived.
And settled. Yeah. And arrived, yes. Like, I feel like, wow, all these years, decades of being in music, but kind of feeling like an outsider, you know? Like, here I have the opportunity to work with people I admire, like commission musicians to make work that I'm a fan of. It's cool. And I'm in a position to do that. And it took some time to get here. So
for somebody who listens to so much music and is curating all this stuff all the time, I want to approach this next question from my own personal feelings about the evolution of music today as it relates to algorithms and the way patterns and chord progressions and synthesizer. All of these things, to me, I feel like music is becoming all the same. Everything sounds the same, feels the same. We could feel like if this is popping off, this like tweak in a song pop or genre pops off, everything's going in that direction because it's capitalizing and bringing in money. Do you feel that way?
Yes. I think it's just, you know, I the music that you're talking about, this level is more of like a mainstream. It's what we hear on the radio. It's pervasive. It's pop culture. And it does sound the same because they're always trying to find the next big thing. And there's a finite amount of time that something or someone will be big, and then they move on to the next one. And it sounds, you know, the produce, what people like today sounds the same. And it there's not a lot of risk takers, and a lot of music is broken on TikTok. And there's a really finite amount of time to capitalize on that moment, or even to get to that moment. And then once you have that moment, how do you, it's hard to get that moment again. So I think it's like social media, it's the way media distributed now. It does sound the same to me, and I makes me nostalgic about just what I grew up listening to. I recently made a playlist. First I was like, oh God, it's gonna be my top, it's gonna be called Anne's Billboard 100, my top 100 songs. I'm like, I can't do that, like there's too many songs. And now it's called my safe space. And it's like 10 hours of music, and then I'm looking at it, I'm like, God, these are songs from like teenage, 20, you know, like a certain moment in my life that's still sticking, but it makes me feel good. And it sounds so, it just sounds great to me. It's timeless. But I think it's because it's that moment that it's all about that moment in time where it informed my identity when I was like forming my ideas and who I am. And maybe that's what's happening to kids with today's music, but I can't relate to it as much.
Yeah, because, you know, what if, because here's the other part of that, there's behind that question is like, what if today there's just such an expansive rate of different types of music and we just can't catch all of it, and at the sort of at the surface level is what probably our parents' generation in America, not our parents, but American people in the 60s were listening to, let's say, music in the 80s, and they're like, oh, it all sounds the same, right?
Yeah.
But it wasn't the same. Mm-hmm. And then I think, like, if we break down, like, let's say Jelly Roll today, for example, right? I like his stuff. I think it's like, oh my God, thank God something like that is raw. It just feels more raw. His lyrics feel more raw. And it's got this like sort of rock, but country, mm-hmm. but also modern feel. And I was like, thank God something like that is like, it invigorates. Yeah, and Jelly Roll is just sort of one example of many today.
It's funny that you bring him up because we have, for hotels.com, we have a series called Perfect 10. And we're in the middle of shooting this season 5, which is music. And on Monday, we're shooting Jelly Roll. And I really wanted him for, you know, just like what you said, there's a lot of genres, still sits in country. I needed someone in country, but just has this like appeal to different crossover audiences.
Yeah.
And maybe that sounds different. I feel like I think, like, you know, my kid who's 10, discovering music right now, you know, Green Day, Nirvana, whatever the algorithm's, you know, suggesting. And I have to, like, I'm trying to channel, like, his brain is, like, not filled with all the stuff that ours are. So it must sound so refreshing. And then he's listening to new music, too. It's like I've just listened to two, like, I've so much in here. So it all sounds the same, but maybe it doesn't, you know?
God, I love this conversation.
I don't know. I really think, for like someone who's a teenager, it doesn't, and that's great.
And I started to really get into Taylor Swift lately. Mm-hmm. And it's important mm-hmm. that we do get into these things that are you know, whether it's K-pop or Taylor Swift, or those things are important to me because I have a 7 and a 5-year-old, and I want to know what they're processing in the lyrics and what kind of things are being reflected in their brains, mm-hmm. what's happening. But when I think about, like, when I was a kid, there was Iron Maiden, there was Megadeth, there was there was Ozzy Osbourne, and then there was like the gentle, you know, Eric Clapton, which wasn't so gentle back then, right? Yeah, but when you look back now and you're like, wow, that was some really gentle rock music. And then, you know, I go back and listen to The Cult or, you know, all of these bands. And then there's like this Cocteau Twins or, you know, there was such a wide variety of things. And then, of course, there's Michael Jackson when, as an adult now, my kids listen to. We love Michael Jackson as we're listening to together. But there's a proliferation of a lot more music than there is when we grew up. There's access to a lot more of it. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, like growing, like when we grew up, if we wanted to find something, we would have to, we read about it, a friend told us, and we would have to figure out how do we get it. And now it's available anytime. Like you can Google anything, you can search up music, and it's, you know what? It's a different sense of discovery.
Yeah.
You'll still have to discover on your own. Yeah, you still have to do the work, but it's just, I'm not going to say it's easier. I mean, it probably is easier, but it's a different way to discover new things. And, you know, that's kind of interesting to me how my kid is going to develop his tastes. And I'm not kind of butting in at all. Like, it's pretty bad right now, but it might, you know, like...
Okay, when you say it's pretty bad, on what level are you saying them...
being snobby.
Yeah, is it his taste is pretty bad or his access is bad? Because that's a very broad thing
I
to
mean,
say.
I mean, I know. I mean, it's, I shouldn't be saying that. I think taste is so subjective. I just, you know, I think he's using Spotify as his, you know, main platform for discovery, and they're suggesting things through their playlist or the algorithm, and it's good, it's a hit or miss. So his first playlist, you know, maybe the first song, you know, he heard about Nirvana, okay, and then they suggested Green Day, great, and then there'll be like AC/DC, not that that's bad, or Aerosmith, not bad, but like I think for me, I grew up very, my jam is being very, finding the deep cuts, finding the hidden gems, finding obscurity. That's the deep research I like. I feel like an outsider in taste as well, because give me the most obscure thing, I'm all for it. And right now he's not getting that. And I don't want to butt in because I could give him, oh my God, you should listen to this, this and that. But it's like, maybe you'll discover it on your own.
But maybe not. Why don't, what's wrong with the little injecting of you?
And I do. It's not, I do. I just like, why don't you listen to this? But I think the time will come. You know, okay, now learn about the mainstream everything now, because that's still education. And that will inform the way things are placed in culture or history, so that when you, you know, find this other artist, you know how to situate them, that they belong here and they were influenced by this or that, you know. But I think it all lives in still pop music, and that's how I grew up. Yes, I loved indie music. Like,
what was indie for you growing up?
Indie for me. And looking back, I was like, damn, I was such an Anglophile. Like, kind of almost embarrassingly, like, I just, like, I, this is a time where Manchester, like, you know, I loved all the bands on Rough Trade or Creation Records or Factory. That was kind of like where I connected most to these bands that were so far from my reality. And I still like that, you know? And it's very niche. I still listen to pop music. I think I still like Duran Duran, and I knew all about the charts, but I really loved indie music, like twee music, you know, like very precious sounding music.
Wait, like what music? Twee?
Like twee, like it's like TWE, like it's like the most like like very cute. It's like, you know, like I loved Hello Kitty too, you know, like, and that's where I love what I really loved, you know, and, you know, it was so different from my world, you know, and I think about what's my kid's world. Well, now he's getting into like hip hop. Okay, great. Cool. You know, that's, you know, you like Travis Scott, Drake. Okay, like, okay. And then yesterday, through the weekend, he, you know, talked about Daft Punk. I'm like, okay, we're getting somewhere. But like, I think there needs to be a base education, which is what he's figuring out. And then from there, you could like take it to the next level. But without that, you need that basis, I think. Yeah.
You know, this is so funny all the time where I invite guests on and, you know, like I, you know, because I love all things, everything. And when I hear, oh, you know, head of music at Expedia, these two things don't match to me. And then I'm like, I can't wait to talk to you about this stuff. And it's almost like now that's like on the back burner. You know, I want to keep talking about music with you forever, like for the next 10 hours.
But I can talk about that.
Yeah, but it's like we came here because we need to talk about your work. But again, I don't want to segue.
No, I can transition to that.
Yeah.
Like my personal taste does go into my work. I mean, that's why I'm there. But I also am very conscious of what works and what doesn't. And like I can leave my personal taste, you know, behind. But I always try to push it too. But I do work in a very corporate, you know, for a giant company.
Let me ask you specifically about that. What works and what doesn't work? Because, I mean, are you the one that we are now looking at? You are the reason why, not you, but people like you are the reasons why the algorithm is working the way it does, because you literally just said, I know what works and what doesn't, and I'm taking my own sort of my own, you're taking your own soul out of it, right?
Yeah.
And because you know what's going to translate into dollars, so you have to make this decision. It needs to go a little bit more mainstream, so I got to place this here.
I mean, there's a lot of factors, but...
I'm not putting you down at all.
No, I know. No, I get it. Like, I mean, there's different ways. For the music that is in the commercials, it's informed by the creative, you know? Rarely does the music inform the creative, except for a few occasions. I mean, last year we have a commercial on hotels.com using a Human League song, Don't You Want Me? You know, big hit from the 80s. But that idea, that song was the original idea that then the creative came from that. That rarely happens, you know. Music is, the music selection is, should elevate the story.
The experience.
The experience. How do we translate this story and take it to the next level? Music can do that. And there's many, you know, we have to look at, well, what are our goals here? Is it finding a famous or known track? So because that's kind of instant memorability, like connection. Do we want that sort of affinity? Is it breaking a new song? Is it, there's a lot of factors, and lyrically, can it help the story? Or maybe there's a lot of VO, so we need to look for an instrumental. How do we want people to feel? Music does that. It can make you feel nostalgic, it can make you feel happy, you know. There's like it's those are the things that we are looking for. Of course, I'm always like, right now, one of the Super Bowl spots, we for Expedia, we have a spot called Northern Lights, and it's with a Velvet Underground song. I mean, that's cool.
Yeah.
Like, I can't believe I was part of that, you know? And that's, for me, from a personal, like, you know, very proud of that. But I can't believe that this is a band that I love and I get to do this, you know? And there's another spot that came out in December for Hotels.com using this French-English 90s band called Stereolab, more obscure, but critical darlings, but not to the level, mm-hmm. you know, the level, but also yeah. they're like probably, but I, that's in a commercial. I can't believe I did that. Mm-hmm. Like, but it worked, you know, like, so it's a, you know, personal taste, but also like understanding that it has to connect with audiences like right away from a pure emotional state. And it could sound any which way, you know? It could be a punk or like metal song. I haven't gotten there yet, but yeah. that would be cool to do.
I can't believe this position is open. Like, it is in a real life seat at a corporation.
Yeah, it's, and I'm one of like, I think, not, I don't know what the stats are, but I'm like their in-house person. Which I think is cool for a company like this to treat music, creativity with this sort of focus. It doesn't happen often.
Okay, so how did you get there? Can you tell me the years leading up to?
Well, I was doing that. I was, you know, at my, you know, creative agency doing that. And it was, you know, boutique, small. It, you know, was my livelihood for a long time, and it was amazing. And I think I just felt at a certain point I had hit my ceiling. And like, you know, owning your own business is, you're hustling.
No fun.
You're not taking vacation. You know, you can't turn off. Yeah. And I think I was tired. I was just like, I don't know. Like, what is the next, what's next? What is the next phase? I could probably do, we could continue doing this, but I wanted something else. I didn't know what that was, but I had, you know, a part of me, even though I told you about my anxiety, like there's like this feeling I have that I can always figure things out and I can take risks. I don't know where maybe I got it from my parents mm-hmm. and them taking a big risk, but I can, you know, I wasn't completely fulfilled. I hit my ceiling. I'm like, I'm so tired hustling. What can I do next? And I sort of just like gave myself 6 months. I'm like, you're going to find something. You don't know what it is, but you're going to put it. This sounds really, I'm not as that new agey or spiritual.
Law of attraction.
But I just like kind of like, once I decided, all these opportunities came. And I wasn't like announcing it, but like, I just like, and it took a while to kind of like, I'm ready for the next thing. Like, and things came. And this job was one of them. And I didn't think it was real. Again, I was like, what is music at Expedia? What do I yeah. do? And it was someone I know who I'm really grateful for. He brought me on because he was brought on and he was leading creative. And we knew each other for a decade, but not well. But he knew what I did. And again, he's also like, I think, a visionary leader where he's like, saw something in me, but it didn't, he didn't need to know specifics. He's like, I think I don't want to sound like overconfident, but like, I think he liked my taste or, you know, like, and I can execute. And so I just didn't really know and what it entailed, but I'm like, I'm just going to do it. And if it's a disaster, it's okay. I'll figure out something else. And that's what happened.
And so the position you hold now wasn't the position you signed up for, you were brought in for, was it?
No, it is the same position.
Oh, okay.
I just didn't, but yeah, it's the same. Nothing's changed. I just didn't, exactly know what it entailed. I knew I could do it, but I didn't know like, the kind of specific kind of dealings, like the day-to-day in a corporate structure. But I knew the framework.
After all this time now, can you kind of like whittle it down to describe to me what you actually do?
At Expedia?
Yeah.
Well, the core thing is music supervision.
Yeah.
So, you know, music creator for content, top to bottom. I work in tandem with partnerships to define music strategy for partnerships. And I create, as an extra thing, create started Culture at Expedia. I enjoy making, you know, themed playlists, quarterly playlists. That's where I discover music for myself, and sort of try to build that community inside the company. That's it.
Yeah. No, but it makes sense why a company like Expedia or Hotels.com and VRBO would need this sort of person to curate.
Yeah, I think they just respect, you know, building something. They want to elevate the storytelling. So I'm part of a new org that came in a few years ago that this was the purpose. Like, we're going to make beautiful stories that really resonate, and, you know, bring awareness to the brands.
You listen to an inordinate amount of music, right?
I do.
And how do you structure that? Like, if it was sort of like a gym routine or a professional athlete, they got to do 6 hours in the gym. How do you break this down?
It's really chaotic. I should exercise more, or if any, but I don't have, I guess on Fridays, I listen, all the releases come out.
Okay.
Okay. So
all right.
I'm on Pitchfork.
How many hours is that?
Let's call it an hour. I don't know.
And when you do listen to it, is it a sprint, or is it like, let me sit down and really listen to all 4 minutes?
Always a sprint. I listen to music very chaotically. Again, like, for instance, Taylor Swift. I listen to it. I can scrub through. I'm like, okay, this is the single. Let's listen. Okay. And then, you know, during the weekend, I'm gardening. I'm doing something instead of the podcast that I like. Well, you know, I'm like, I'm going to listen to her album just like I did Beyonce's. Beyonce's when it came out. Because this is what people are talking about.
Yep.
And I need to know.
You need to be educated.
And yeah. I, like someone already asked me, what do you think of the new Taylor Swift? I knew what to say because, you know, it's part of the job. And so I do that. They're like, I just finished an Earth Day or Earth Month playlist that I spent a lot of time because I was excited to do this because I hadn't made this sort of Earth theme playlist before. So it's going to be a challenge. And it's exciting to research and learn new songs. And I think that's why I'm in the job I am, because I love to research. So I'm reading. It takes me from one end to the next. I find out more songs. The playlists I make for work, there's no vetting or process. Of course, there's a standard crisis team vetting of any sort of controversial lyrics or artists. But beyond that, I'm like, I want different genres. I work for a travel company. It should sound global. I'm looking for different stories. I'm looking for narratives. And I told the team, like, you know, this topic could be a little, how deep do we want to go as a company? And they're like, we can go deep. And then I kind of knew the answer is like, okay, not too deep. So I know I can gauge, you know, there's always fun songs, but there's serious songs. I just finished it. I'll share it with you. It's pretty good. There's deep cuts. There's always deep cuts. There's always some mainstream acts. There's always mainstream song or mainstream artists, but deeper cuts. So there's, you know, and there's a cadence with the flow of the music, and that's my discovery. And there's no, I guess in terms of like its routine or schedule, that takes a long time. And I need to allocate space for it. Like sometimes it's late at night, sometimes it's taking a shower, sometimes it's driving. And I'm just listening to it in the flow to make sure like, if it works, you know. So it's like training for a big project.
Yeah.
I don't know.
These curated playlists that you have to put together, where is that being consumed? Who consumes this and what are you doing it for?
I mean, it's just for the companies, like it's on the Expedia's Spotify channel. it's really for internal, well, it's public, so it's not internal, but it's for the kind of culture at Expedia. And it's something that it's a good muscle and tool for me to learn about music. And now I know everything, a lot about songs about, you know, sustainability and ecology.
And is for the internal ecosystem at Expedia, or is it for the public?
I do both. Yeah.
So, are they different playlists?
Yeah. I mean, I do like in the fall, there's like the trends playlist. I work with PR and comms, and that's like, you know, distributed widely. It's really to create culture at Expedia.
Inside of Expedia.
Yeah, it is. And it's I like it. It's not that amplified. It's actually kind of, in terms of the bigger picture, kind of small. But I think for me, it's my portal into new music and to music from the past. And that informs me for the other projects.
And the value of the playlist that you do, how does Expedia understand the value of that? And I don't mean that by like the dollar's value, but is that something that you were directed to do? Is that part
no,
of the directive?
No, this is something extra that I'm doing because it helps me with the other like responsibilities. Do you know what I mean? It's like, this is my own sense of discovery.
Yeah.
And it keeps me updated with new music, and it keeps me discovering music that I don't know about. Like next month in a few weeks, Expedia does this annual travel conference in Vegas called Explore. So I'm doing the music program for that. So there's Sonic Identity that's been created, where it's custom, you know, Sonic Heroes, you know, what that goes with the logo, and I'm doing the walk-on music. That's all custom. And I'm doing playlists, and I've invited music curators or people I know in the music world to make their own playlists for this project. It's a fun thing to do. If there's at the bottom, like,
shit.
It's fun to... learn stuff you don't know about. And because I'm always trying to find something else. Like, my personal taste right now in the last decade isn't pop music. It's like contemporary classical. Because I don't know anything about it. Like, I can tell you what a Taylor Swift, Olivia Rodrigo, I can be like, oh, that's influenced by this artist who's influenced by that. You could trace it. But in this kind of contemporary classical world, it's a bit fuzzier for me. Like, I don't know what this sounds like or how this person was influenced by what, you know? And so I read up on it. I have a little radio show about it. It's my own personal education.
Wait, you said radio show?
It's an online radio show.
That you do out of your house?
It's for this online station called Dublab. They've been together, I mean, like 20 plus
years. Yeah, I've
heard
of Dublab, yeah.
Yeah, so it's occasional. I have an occasional radio show when I feel up for it. So.
Oh my God, it's so awesome. It's like you work, but you're not... I mean, you must not feel like you're going and doing work.
No, you're right. No, it's. I'm very grateful for my job. I guess I've accepted, like, I am in music. Like, for a long time, I thought I was like, well, yeah, I was in a band. Yeah, I did this, but I'm not really in the music industry.
No, you are knee deep in the
music. Do you know what I mean? But now I'm like, I guess I'm in the music industry. Like, I am. I still feel a little bit not fully like in it. But I think that's just, there's not as many females. There's not many Asians. It's, you know, like, these things are obvious to me. So it's a factor I, you know, it's just in my face all the time, you know.
What do you think the future of music is? Is it all moving towards one sound, or is it actually growing and it's becoming a more varied landscape that's becoming more beautiful?
I don't know. I know that it's always evolving and it's always looking back. So maybe if it sounds the same to us, it may not be like that for someone else right now. I think it's hard to say. The reason why it sounds the same is us, when we grew up, there was just the radio and there wasn't these DSPs, and what you heard was what you heard, you know. Now every, you know, the history of music is at your fingertips. You can search any, and now there's more music than ever, and we're just gonna have more and more music, and only the select few will break through. And so you have just a lot of music that does sound the same. I think it will constantly change. I think there's always going to be amazing, iconic artists that will make statements. And let's just see. I think music is one of the most dynamic things mm-hmm. happening.
Do you follow music in Vietnam?
I should more. I know there's like a Vietnamese American artist that was the first to play Coachella, Thuy. I know of that female rapper, Suboy. And I should know more. Maybe that's my next thing.
And there's a Grammy winner. I think she won last year, Sangeeta.
Okay.
Her Vietnamese name is Teresa Mai.
Okay.
But she's like into yoga and, you know, so she's in a different tradition musically, and she's changed her name because of that. But
I see. There's a new indie artist, like, I just heard the song. I was like, this is good. What is this? And then I saw her name, like Hannah Vu.
Yeah, Hannah's been around for a bit.
She's so young, though.
Yeah, she's been around for a few years.
And so I'm like, I like this. This is something I would love. Like, I would have, like, I was already drawn to it, but I'm like, if I was like a younger person, I'm like, I would eat this up. And I just, you know, I'm well versed with 88 Rising. Like, I need, maybe I'm going to go to Vietnam during winter break. So I wish, you know, I hope that, you know, Vietnamese or Asian artists making music, that they create their own path. So much is influenced by contemporary Western trends that it sounds like anyone can make it, but we're just highlighting it, oh, because she's Asian or she's Vietnamese, but it could be anyone making it, and maybe that's fine, but is there an artist that can truly make something unique that feels Vietnamese? I don't know.
That's a great question.
Do you know?
That is a great question.
Like when you look at like jazz or just like the root of music, and you can stem it back, but like can Vietnamese, you know, like can you take like the traditional Vietnamese music and popularize it to today's culture? But it's inherently taken from that.
Yeah, this is my answer to that. I think somebody will eventually do it.
Eventually.
Yeah, somebody will figure it out. The Bob Dylan, and I'm not saying musically or stylistically, but the Bob Dylan in terms of like just taking that step to create something so big and powerful in the 60s for the American world. Somebody is going to do that in our lifetime for the Vietnamese to cross over internationally, I think. It's just bound to happen, because I think when you think about the Vietnamese music culture, it is beautiful. There's a lot of inherent beauty in it, mm-hmm. but it hasn't found its way into pop culture like the K-pop scene has. But somebody's going to crack it.
Yeah.
I think
if we're going to get there in our lifetime, I think we're just like maybe one generation removed. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, because of the war, because of like access to culture, you know, like being part of the more global cultural conversation, we're getting there. But and that's how I felt when I went back to Vietnam, where musically I grew up, you know, ingesting this other type of music, and I was hungry for that. But there, what it was, it didn't exist in Vietnam. And then even art, you know, there was like traditional Vietnamese art, but like where was the contemporary scene? There was a small one, but it wasn't there yet. There wasn't access to the sort of awareness or education or the history.
I was just going to comment on that. If you look at anything or anybody that breaks through, this is just a generality for me. Like if you think about The Sympathizer and Viet Thanh Nguyen, right? When you start to break down, like when people are able to do that kind of work, the amount of scholarly work that they've done. So as an artist or writer, even when you think of Bob Dylan, you think about his political awareness. You think about Bao Nguyen, who did Grace Nine Pop and Be Water. You think about the breadth of knowledge that they have. And then that gift of artistry, like Viet Thanh Nguyen or Bao Nguyen, they come into the scene and then they can do things to elevate the art. And when it comes to, let's just say, that singer in Vietnam or that music talent, they're going to have to be at least at the scholarly level to kind of break free from whatever the noise is, because they've already seen everything. It's almost like somebody like you, right? On your level, but who gets the whole picture and then they break it.
It's just awareness and understanding of just history.
Yeah.
And taking that and making it your own.
Right.
Or like, you know, Ocean Vuong
right.
is another one, I think, where...
He is another one, yeah.
Just so smart, just so aware of how things are connected, and then making it his own. So I, you know, when I met you that night, or just like the last, you know, I guess like meeting Bao, I was like, gosh, there's this, these, like, where have these people been in my life? You know, like, and seeing Thuy play Coachella, like it's really cool that we are kind of going out there and being seen, because there's not a lot of us in culture or in this type of world. There isn't. And it's really cool to see where it takes you. Yeah, but we do need to create something inherently like us, with different influences for sure, but not repurposing the same tropes and stereotypes and sound.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just time, I think.
It's just time. Like the best chefs I know, the best Vietnamese chefs that I know in LA are guys that are so well-versed in like Mexican tradition, traditional cooking. They're so well-versed in French cooking. You know, they have this huge breadth of knowledge in their field, and then they're going out to break new grounds in their own Vietnamese specificity, in their own niche down kind of area, because they understand like all of it. And the same with like these people that will show up one day in the music scene in Vietnam. I think that their understanding of K-pop or Italian pop music or new wave, it's good. There, if you sit with somebody like who are scholarly at their craft, they're going to be able to create that sound that you're like, oh my God, that person's arrived. Mm-hmm. And we haven't seen it yet, because I think it just takes time for more exposure.
Yeah. And it's also like just access to, I guess, technology or to information.
Which in Vietnam, I think it's wide open, to be honest.
And then taking that and being innovative about it. We'll see. I'm excited. There's a lot of other things coming out of Vietnam that people have been telling me about, like young people making, you know, DJs or, you know, it sounds all very exciting.
Yeah. Well, this was an exciting conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. I am not surprised at all. Yeah. Because I kind of can guess, you know, like when we're working at this like corporate level, at this, you know, when you're given a title in the corporate world and but it's like, wait a minute, it's like, it's a corporate title, but it's like there's music involved, and it's got to be some interesting person behind this. And I'm able to kind of like see and recognize these things now, where I'm able to like, I hop right on it, right? I get right on it. I'm like, I have to get this person on because I want to open up my understanding. I want to be the scholar in my tradition, right? Which is like, when we think about cataloging Vietnamese people in the world, I want to be that sort of that encyclopedia of like, yeah, within music, there's this, and it, you know, there's a huge, big, you can go in a rabbit hole when you think about Vietnamese people in music in the United States and Vietnam. It's and all around the world now. Mm-hmm. It's like there's so many levels to it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm glad you're doing this and documenting it.
Yeah. Thank you for coming on the podcast today.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Anh.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.